We have been talking about the different insights from the work with non-ordinary states and the implications. For me personally, the most exciting aspect and the most interesting aspect of the work with non-ordinary states was what we learned about death. You know, death is something that's absolutely universal, relevant for everybody, and at the same time has in the past gotten so little attention. It was really until the late 1960s the topic of death was practically ignored, not just by the general population, but also by people who worked in disciplines that should be very much interested in this subject, such as medicine, psychiatry, psychology, anthropology, philosophy, and even theology. The only plausible explanation that I can think about the situation is really massive denial that existed in our culture. So this disinterest that was there in the past is even more striking when we compare it with the situation in pre-industrial and ancient cultures, where death was something that was extremely important and had a very significant role. Death played a very critical and central role in the cosmologies of these cultures, in their philosophies, in their spiritual and ritual life, and also in their mythologies. And it was also something that was very important in their everyday life. Now, the difference between the attitude towards death in these pre-industrial cultures and in the Western industrial civilization becomes very obvious when we compare the situation of a person dying in one of these ancient or pre-industrial cultures with the situation of an average Westerner dying in our society. When we look at the Western civilization, our worldview is basically dictated by materialistic science, which is telling us that the universe is a mechanical system, is a material system. The history of the universe is the history of developing matter. And in this context, life, consciousness, and intelligence are seen as more or less accidental and insignificant side products of this development. They appeared on the scene after many billions of years of evolution of matter, and they appeared in a trivially small part of an immense universe, even if there are other worlds where there is life, you know, still in comparison with the dimensions of the universe and the billions of galaxies. The existence of life, consciousness, and intelligence would be an insignificant phenomenon. So we see in Western science consciousness as a product of the physiological processes in the brain. And from this perspective, it seems obvious that when the body dies, the brain dies, this is the absolute end of not only our existence, but also consciousness. Another important thing that somehow shapes the situation of a person dying in our culture is that we haven't paid really much attention to the psychological processes in dying people, whether it was a process of slow dying or some kind of sudden confrontation with death. Professionals until quite recently paid practically no attention to the experiences associated with dying and the psychological problems that emerge here. The next important factor is that we really have not developed any specific psychological support for dying people, people with terminal diseases, so that they find themselves involved in a profound crisis, in a crisis that is emotional, that is physical, psychological, philosophical, and spiritual. At the same time, this seems to be the only situation where no specific help is being offered. We have developed crisis intervention and support system for just about every crisis except this ultimate and this phenomenal crisis that a dying person faces. One of the reasons why a person in our culture is very lonely and isolated in that situation is also the disintegration of the family system. That in many instances, parents and children and other relatives live in different places very far apart, and they might just see each other once in a few years or or communicate by telephone. We also experience a very powerful denial in relation to death. For example, we don't want to deal with people who are sick or dying. They are sort of isolated from the rest of the society. They're in hospitals, in hospices, in nursing homes. The extreme of this kind of denial would be, for example, Forest Lawn in Los Angeles, where they have people who are sort of posthumous barbers, posthumous tailors, plastic surgeons who would arrange a smile on the face of the deceased so that this whole situation would not really remind us of our own mortality and impermanence, would not generate fear. Now, the last thing that I would like to say is that we don't have any specific preparation or training for the experience of death the way we have for many other situations. Now, this is very different in these ancient and pre-industrial societies. They have cosmologies, philosophies, mythologies, in which somehow death is not presented as the absolute end of everything, but as a very important transition. Consciousness and existence does not end with death. There is something in the beyond, and they have very detailed maps of the posthumous journey and of the posthumous realms, of the different boats of the deceased, the paradises, the heavens, the hells, and so on. And many cultures have also the belief in reincarnation, the idea that we come back and get another physical form. Now, this can be so extreme that the situation is seen as being kind of inverted, that death is more important than life. For example, in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, it's absolutely essential how we face the experience with the Dharmakaya, the primary clear light that appears to us at the time of death. If we are well prepared, this is an opportunity for instant liberation. If we cannot face it with equanimity, we will be sort of moved to another incarnation. And the way we deal with that experience was the passing through the bardos, the intermediate state between death and birth, will ultimately determine the nature of our whole next incarnation. People dying in these ancient and industrial cultures also get tremendous psychological support. In these cultures, we find extended families. People die in the context of a clan, of a tribe, surrounded by people whom they intimately know. In many of these cultures, there's also ritual support. There's a rite of passage that has been performed for dying people. Again, the extreme example of this is the Bardo Tadal, a text that helps it to guide somehow the deceased person through this process. Now, probably the most interesting difference is that these ancient and pre-industrial cultures have actually something that we can refer to as experiential preparation, as experiential training for dying, which we find in many different forms. One of them is related to the institution of shamanism that I've already talked about. What is very characteristic for the experience of the shaman is that he or she, in this initiatory journey or in some kind of later journeys, inner journeys, would repeatedly visit what the Tibetans call the Bardo realm, the realm of death, which can be seen as a kind of process of familiarization with that experience. This is true for the clients of the shaman, who very frequently, as part of the healing, would undergo powerful experiences of death and rebirth that bring them in touch with this whole posthumous realm. So the beginning of the career of the shaman is very intimately associated with this powerful visionary experience, with a non-ordinary state of consciousness. But the significance of a non-ordinary state continues even beyond that, because non-ordinary states of consciousness are an important part of the activity of the shaman, particularly the healing activity. When a shaman works with a client, he or she would enter a non-ordinary state of consciousness. In some other instances, they induce a non-ordinary state of consciousness in the client, or both the shaman and the client enter a non-ordinary state of consciousness. In some other instances of healing ceremonies, it can happen that the entire tribe is in a non-ordinary state. For example, the trance of the Kalahari Bushmen, where they dance throughout the night and they experience kind of an activation of the energy that is normally dormant in the sacral area, energy which is actually quite similar to the Kundalini energy described in tantric yoga. And then in these Kalahari Bushmen rituals, we see people going through powerful energy states with emotional abreaction, with shaking and twisting movements of the body, resulting in very powerful healing and transformation. So the shamanic crisis and the phenomena observed in shamanism serve as a very important model for the spiritual emergencies, because they show that one can experience a very powerful non-ordinary state and benefit from it and experience healing, but they also lead to the alleviation of fear of death. The second area which provides a very, very powerful training for dying is the area of rituals, particularly the so-called rites of passage. Those are powerful rituals enacted at the time of biological or social transitions, where the native cultures use technologies of the sacred to induce non-ordinary states. And in these rituals, the initiates experience powerful experiences of death and psychospiritual rebirth. And in the context of these rituals of transition, this is interpreted as death in some kind of old state and move into a new status. For example, in the puberty rite, the idea is that it's the boys and the girls who die and adults are born. And from then on, they are treated by the tribe as adults. They have all the rights and all the duties of adults. Now, people living in these cultures, they would experience repeatedly during their lifetime, in the context of these rituals, encounter with death and transcendence of death. So that when death then comes, it's not the first time they encounter this experiential territory, and it eases very much the transition. The third area that provides training for death in the ancient cultures is related to the institution of mysteries of death and rebirth. And this is very closely related to mythologies of death and rebirth that exist and developed independently in many different areas of the world. Those are powerful stories about deities, about demigods, about legendary heroes who either are killed and come back to life, or they sacrifice themselves and are reborn, or in some instances they undertake a journey into the underworld, which is really an equivalent of dying, and then they return back to our world. So these are stories, for example, like the descent of the goddess, descent of Inanna into the underworld to find the elixir of immortality to bring back to life her lover Tammuz, that is found in the Sumerian culture. This is the story of Isis and Osiris, where Osiris is killed and dismembered by his brother Set, and then their sisters Nephthys and Isis collect the pieces and resurrect Osiris, and he then becomes the king of the underworld. We have similar stories about Dionysus, who was killed and dismembered by the Titans and then revived. Story of Attis and Adonis, both deities who also underwent death and rebirth. We have in the Nordic literature similar story of Wotan experiencing this powerful transformation as he was hanging on the Yggdrasil, the world tree, and traded somehow his eye for esoteric knowledge, the knowledge of the runes. And we have two powerful transformation stories in the Mesoamerican culture, the story of Quetzalcoatl, who committed incest during alcohol intoxication by Pulque, and when he sobered up and discovered what happened, he immolated himself and then underwent this journey through the underworld, experienced rebirth and transformation into the planet Venus. And the corresponding Mayan story about the hero twins who were invited by the lords of the underworld to play with them a ball game. And in this context, they were subjected to a number of major ordeals during which they were killed and came back to life and then again were transformed into celestial bodies. Now, in all these places where there were the powerful death rebirth mythologies, they also had institutions providing initiation for neophytes. For example, the Sumerian mysteries of Inanna and Tammuz, the Egyptian mysteries of Isis and Osiris, the mysteries of Dionysus, the Bacchanalia, the Dionysian rites, the mysteries of Attis and Adonis and the Corybants, and the Nordic mysteries of Wotan, and in Middle America, the mysteries of Xibalba, based on the Mayan myth. Now, the most famous of these mysteries were the mysteries in Eleusis, or Eleftis, as it is called in modern Greek. These were conducted about 14 miles from Athens. They were conducted every 5 years for a period of almost 2,000 years. And in these mysteries, the initiates underwent a very powerful experience of death and rebirth, which was associated with the mythological story of the abduction of Persephone by Pluto, where she was abducted into the underworld, and then at the intervention of the gods, she was returned, at least for part of the year. I was actually then traveling back and forth between the underworld and the external world. Now, the participants in these mysteries were frequently very influential and prominent figures of antiquity. So, for example, we know that Plato and Aristotle were initiates of these mysteries, and they wrote about it. Aristotle's term catharsis, the emotional purification, comes from his discussion of these mysteries. Among the other prominent personalities, there was Pindaros, the poet, and there was Euripides, the playwright, and also Cicero, the Roman statesman and lawyer. Now, the interesting question here is, what were they offering to people that they kept somehow the attention of the ancient world for a period of almost 2,000 years? Obviously, that had to be something pretty impressive. Now, we have some indications that what was happening here was actually induction of non-ordinary states and sequences of psychospiritual death and rebirth. There's a very interesting book by three authors, by Albert Hofmann, the discoverer of LSD, Gordon Wasson, who is the man who brought the magic mushrooms from the Mazatecs from Mexico to Europe and gave them to Albert Hofmann for the analysis and the isolation of the active alkaloids. And the third person of this team was Karl Rack, a Greek scholar. And these three people wrote this book called Road to Eleusis, where after years of really meticulous study, they came to the conclusion that the key to these mysteries was a sacred potion, a beverage called Kykeon, which is K-Y-K-E-O-N, which was actually a preparation from ergot, that's a parasite on rye, it's a fungus. And it happens to be also the source of lysergic acid, which is the principal component of LSD. So according to them, this was a psychedelic cult or religion that survived a period of almost 2,000 years from 1400 BC to 400 AD. And even then, the antique world didn't lose interest in these mysteries, but the activities in the mysteries were stopped by an edict of the Pope. It was a part of the movement of Christian Church against any kind of pagan activities and rituals. Now, when Christina and I visited Eleusis, we were impressed by the size of the ruins, particularly the main hall where these initiations happened. It's called the Telestrion. And we asked the guide how many people participated in these mysteries, and I was just astounded to hear that this was over 3,000 people at a time. So this is an incredible number as compared to the size of the antique world, and particularly the fact that very prominent personalities participated in these rituals. So this had to have enormous impact on the Greek culture, and then from then on European culture in general, because we see the Greek culture as a kind of a cradle of European civilization. So this is a kind of a well-kept secret, something that really has to be rectified by the historian. The impact of these mysteries has been definitely largely underestimated. Now, in all these three situations, in the shamanic tradition, in the rites of passage, and in the death-rebirth mysteries, we have a very interesting phenomenon which we can call dying before dying. This is the basic idea that we can experience the profound confrontation with death while we are still physically healthy, long before the biological demise, and by experiencing death and subsequent rebirth, we actually free ourselves from the fear of death, and we somehow are able to alter our experience of dying when death comes. But that's not the whole story. By freeing ourselves from the fear of death, we also radically transform our way of being in our everyday reality, where we are able to enjoy life much more, we are able to be much more in the present moment, and we have a kind of a direct connection with the spiritual dimensions of reality. This is a very interesting statement by an Augustinian monk from Germany from the 17th century, Augustine of Santa Clara, who said, "A man who dies before he dies does not die when he dies." That means when we are incarnated, we have to have the experience of death sometime, but we don't have to wait until we die biologically. We can kind of do the homework during our lifetime, and that very much eases somehow the situation at the time of biological death. We have made some observations that actually bring direct support or evidence for this idea of dying before dying. At Spring Grove, at the Maryland Psychiatric Research Center, we did an extensive study of terminal cancer patients using psychedelic therapy. And the intention here was to induce mystical experiences that would help these patients to overcome fear of death and transform their experience of dying, and also help them from severe pain, frequently pain that didn't respond to opiates or narcotic medication. And in this study, we did this psychedelic work with over 200 patients. And among these patients, there were several of them who had had the psychedelic experiences with us. And then later, as their disease progressed, they actually had real near-death experiences. For example, one patient who had multiple metastases, and one of them was a metastasis into the ureter, obstructing the ureter and the flow of urine. And he had to have an operation. And during this operation, he had an experience of cardiac arrest. And then when he was resuscitated, he came back to life and to consciousness. We talked to him, and he told us that he was very happy that he had had these psychedelic experiences because he realized that the experiential territory was the same, and that the fact that he had been there has somehow significantly helped him to face the situation of the actual near-death experience. There's also another opportunity to experience confrontation with death, and then particularly the transcendence into the transpersonal realm, and that's a wide range, a wide spectrum of spiritual procedures developed as part of the various traditions. So this would be the different systems of yoga, the different schools of Buddhism, from Theravada or Hinayana to Zen and Vajrayana, the Taoist spiritual practice, the different schools of Sufism, Kabbalah, Christian mysticism, particularly the practice of hesychasm or Jesus prayer, and so on. All those are, in a way, possibilities for practicing dying and transcendence of the body that can then be relevant in terms of the final confrontation with the biological demise. And there were also many texts in different cultures, which we now call books of the dead, that somehow included instructions for the dying people, representing kind of guides on the posthumous journey. And they were also, in most instances, seen as manuals that you can use during your spiritual practice, sort of practicing dying before dying. So the famous Bardo Tuedol describes the intermediate state between death and subsequent rebirth, but at the same time it's understood in the Tibetan tradition that all those experiences described in the Tibetan Book of the Dead can also be experienced during spiritual practice while one is still alive. A parallel to it is the Egyptian Book of the Dead, or Pertem Hru. There's also the Codex Borgia, an Aztec codex, that serves a similar function by describing the posthumous journey of the soul of Quetzalcoatl. And in the Mayan culture, we don't have a codex that would describe it, but some researchers showed that certain funeral vases are decorated by images from something that must have been a Maya book of death, so they refer to it as the ceramic codex. And in Europe, we had a body of literature created in Middle Ages that is referred to as Ars Moriendi, or the art of dying. So if we now look at these experiences from ancient and pre-industrial cultures, the experiences of dying people, and compare them to the experiences of a dying Westerner, we see many advantages that people in pre-industrial cultures had as compared to an average Westerner. Now, the interesting question that emerges here is, how relevant are those elements of the belief system in these pre-industrial cultures? From the perspective of Western materialistic science, they are based on superstition, on delusions, on primitive magical thinking. The interpretation coming from Western science would be that these cultures don't have profound enough understanding of reality. They don't have science. They are afraid of their impermanence and mortality and unable somehow to see their own insignificance, to face their mortality. They create these stories, fairy tale kind of stories about the posthumous journey of the soul and reincarnation. But those are basically kind of wishful fantasies that help them to cope with their fear of the unknown. I would like to now look at a lot of observations and experiences that come from modern consciousness research, from the study of non-ordinary states, that actually support or even validate some of the elements of the worldview of the Aboriginal cultures. We will see that this kind of difference between the worldview of pre-industrial cultures and the industrial civilization in regard to consciousness and death do not reflect superiority of Western materialistic science, but rather unfamiliarity or even naivete of the industrial culture in relation to non-ordinary states. We'll be able to discuss two categories of experiences somehow directly supporting the possibility of consciousness surviving after death. The first would be certain general observations that represent a serious challenge to the materialistic worldview, according to which consciousness is nothing but a product of the neurophysiological processes in the brain. And they will lead to a worldview within which somehow the idea of survival of consciousness after death will be seen as possible or even plausible. And then we'll discuss the second area of experiences and observations that are directly related to the issue of consciousness surviving after death. So we'll now first look at experiences and observations that challenge the traditional understanding of the nature of consciousness and its relationship to matter. This has primarily something to do with the category of experiences that I've already briefly referred to, which we now call transpersonal. Those are experiences in which we transcend somehow the boundaries of the body ego or the skin encapsulated ego, and we suddenly experience identification with other people, we experience group consciousness, we can identify with all of humanity, we can identify with different animal species on the different levels of the Darwinian pedigree, we can also experience identification with various forms of plant life or even experience consciousness that seems to be associated with non-organic materials and processes. And some of these transpersonal experiences can also take us into the archetypal domains, into the world of deities, demons, mythological realms, and so on. So this study of the possibility of consciousness extending beyond the body is extremely important for the issue of survival of consciousness after death. This is something that William Rohl called theta consciousness, or what the Iroquois Native Americans called the long body. So if we look at the transpersonal experiences, we'll have to change our definition of what it is to be a human being. Naturalistic science developed an image of the human being as basically a Newtonian object, an assembly of cells and tissues and organs, and sees consciousness within this context as being a product of the brain. If we now seriously explore the transpersonal experiences, we have to create another definition of human beings, that under some circumstances, namely when we are experiencing a non-ordinary state of consciousness, we actually appear to be a field of consciousness that transcends time, space, and linear causality. So we have now two complementary definitions of what it is to be a human being, which in some sense is like a remote echo of what we find in physics as a definition of subatomic matter and also light. I'm talking here about the so-called wave-particle paradox, that physicists have found that subatomic matter and light in certain experiments can be seen as particles, as sort of microscopic objects that have a certain size, a certain mass, a certain momentum, and so on. But in experiments that are structured in a different way, light and subatomic matter would appear to have wave-like properties. And the physicists tried to reconcile these two images and get one sort of visualizable model, as Albert Einstein talked about it, but then actually capitulated. And Niels Bohr, one of the founders of quantum physics, formulated the so-called complementarity principle, that in order to define light or subatomic matter, we just simply have to accept that we are dealing with particles and waves, and these are two complementary aspects of the same phenomenon that manifest under different circumstances. So we have some kind of parallel, which is not just an extrapolation from the subatomic level to the macro level. We would be jumping too many levels, but we can say that science is studying human beings, such as anthropology, experimental psychiatry, experiential psychotherapy, thanatology, parapsychology, and so on, accumulated now evidence suggesting that we have to formulate a similar kind of definition for human beings, which is a complementary definition. We are not just material objects, but we are also infinite fields of consciousness transcending time and space. Now, what this would mean then for the possibility of consciousness surviving after death is that we would have a situation that at the time of biological death, one of the sides of this complementary definition is abolished with the death of the physical body, but then we fully sort of move into the other aspect of ourselves in which we are basically a field of consciousness that continues to exist. Now we come to the experiences and observations specifically related to the understanding of death and survival of consciousness. The first interesting phenomenon here would be the experiences related to the threshold of death. So many researchers have reported a variety of very interesting phenomena happening at the time when certain people die. So here belong, for example, numerous visions of people who just had died that are reported by their relatives, friends, and acquaintances. There are some studies, such as, for example, Sidgwick studies from the 19th century, suggesting that these kinds of visions happened with great statistical incidence around 12 hours around the death of that person. So the person dies, and simultaneously within 12 hours, relatives or friends would have visions, apparitions of this person. Very frequently with some kind of signs that these people don't know. For example, if there was an accident and there is a particular kind of an injury, these people might see the person with that injury, and they know what happened long before they get the information. There are also many reports of unexplained physical events that are exactly timed with the death of certain individuals. For example, a person dies, and at exactly the same time, the picture of that person in a remote home would fall off the wall, or let's say the clock stops at exactly that time. Another form of interesting experience would be the visions and apparitions that dying people have. There's, for example, a paper by Carlis Osis, which is called Deathbed Observations of Physicians of Nurses. What we have here is people who are dying, and they start having visionary states, and within these visionary states, they would be meeting their relatives who had died before them. This is a kind of a welcoming committee. People who come and they interact with them, they might be kind of inviting them and really easing the transition. Now, there's a particular form of research here that has been referred to as peak in Darien cases, which has to do with the fact that when the dying person sees these people who had died before, there should be only people who are already dead. There should not be any persons who are living. And in many instances it happens that among those who are part of this welcoming committee, there is a person who died, but the dying person is not aware of the fact that the person died. Now, of particular interest would be another threshold phenomenon, which would be a near-death experience that occurs in about one-third of the people who encounter life-threatening situations, such as car accidents, near drowning, heart attacks, cardiac arrests during operations, and so on. We have now a vast body of research by people like Raymond Moody, Ken Ring, Michael Sabum, Bruce Grayson, and others, who somehow defined a very specific experiential pattern that can be observed in the people under these circumstances, which involves, you know, the famous phenomena of, for example, life review, passing through the tunnel, encounter with a radiant divine being, the being of light, being subjected to a judgment, and so on. Very frequently, these are ecstatic transcendental experiences. Less frequent, but also occurring, are experiences which are painful, frightening, anxiety-provoking, even infernal types of near-death experiences. I have already mentioned earlier that we made some observations in our cancer patients who had psychedelic sessions and simultaneously at a later date had real near-death experiences that they talked about how similar these two types of experiences were. Now, there's one particular aspect of these near-death experiences which is very fascinating and is particularly interesting because it lends itself to objective verification, and that's the phenomenon of so-called veridical out-of-body experiences, or OOBEs. Now, what I'm referring to here is a situation where a person in the near-death situation experiences separation of consciousness from the body, and then is capable of, in this kind of bodiless condition, maintain the capacity of perception. For example, would be observing the body from a position on the ceiling, or might even decide to go and check something that's happening in other parts of the building, in other rooms of the building, or even in very remote locations that might be, you know, several hundred miles or thousand miles away. This really is reminiscent of the so-called bardo body, which is described in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, where the idea is that when we die, we can become the so-called bardo body that has free access to any place on the earth. The exception that is being given usually is Bodh Gaya and then the mother's womb. What it basically means that the person is either already incarnated or is enlightened. So all the other experiential realms are available. There is a very fascinating research happening now, which is done by Ken Ring, the very prominent researcher in thanatology, who works with people who are congenitally blind. They have never seen anything in their life. And he's now showing that even they would have visual near-death experiences. And he's specifically looking for the so-called veridical out-of-body experiences, which means that not only do they see something, but what they see can be verified by other people. Now, out-of-body experiences and veridical out-of-body experiences can also happen outside of the near-death situations, in a variety of situations, either spontaneously or during powerful forms of experiential psychotherapy, such as primal therapy, rebirthing, holotropic breathwork. It can happen under the influence of LSD or some other psychedelics, particularly the so-called dissociative anesthetic ketamine, which the surgeons use for anesthesia. Now, these are particularly interesting from the point of view of survival of consciousness after death, because what they show is that consciousness can operate independently of the body. That obviously, consciousness is capable of doing something that the brain cannot possibly do. And although these people are not completely dead, they are just in near-death situations, it seems to be quite plausible that if consciousness can operate independently of the body while the body is alive, there's no reason to assume that it couldn't operate even after the body is dead. The next category of phenomena that provide somehow direct support for the idea of consciousness survival after death would be the past life experiences, reincarnation experiences. This can be divided into several categories. There could be experiences spontaneously occurring in children, experiences spontaneously occurring in adults, evoked experiences in adults, and then we can also talk about certain observations from the Tibetan Vajrayana tradition that are directly related to the possibility of survival of consciousness after death. Now, what is important is that when we talk about the belief in reincarnation, it is really not belief in the sense that this would be some kind of opinion or position that is unfounded, unsupported by observations. For the Hindus, for the Buddhists, and for other cultures that have this belief, reincarnation is basically a pragmatic matter. It is a conceptual framework that is trying to account for certain very distinct and very unusual experiences. According to Christopher Beige, who wrote a wonderful book on reincarnation called Life Cycles, the evidence in this area is so rich and extraordinary that scientists who do not think that the problem of reincarnation deserves serious study are, according to him, either uninformed or boneheaded. So if we look at the spontaneous experiences in children, we'll find out that in many countries of the world, and not just countries that believe in reincarnation, but even in countries like United States, Britain, Turkey, and so on, there are many instances of little children who usually between the age of specific circumstances, something that we can call just specific situations, various idiosyncrasies and so on, that seem to be meaningfully related to the stories they are telling about this previous lifetime. Ian Stevenson, who is a professor of psychology at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville, has conducted very meticulous study of over 3,000 of such cases and reported them in a series of books. For example, 20 cases suggestive of reincarnation, or another one, unlearned languages, one called Children Who Remember Previous Lives, and so on, where he selected about 700 of these cases out of the total pool of 3,000, cases where he felt were absolutely well documented, when there was no possibility for fraud or where there was no other explanation, for example, that the family benefited financially or in terms of social prestige or public attention and so on. And he describes quite remarkable situations. For example, in many instances, he was able to identify the town that the child was talking about. He was able to take the child there. And the child visited this town for the first time in his or her life and was familiar with the entire topography of this town, knew by names the people whom he was meeting, was able to take Stevenson to the house where he or she lived, and so on. In one particularly famous case of Parmo Charma, this child claimed that he was a businessman and that he was selling biscuits and soda. And when they came to the town, they actually found the house where he lived and the corresponding firm. And then, as part of this research, they created a malfunctioning of the machine that was producing the soda, and this little child was able to correct it without any hesitation. In his last books, a kind of a two-volume set, Ian Stevenson described specifically cases which were associated with some very striking birthmarks, where these children talked about their death in a previous lifetime, and they had birthmarks corresponded to the mortal wounds, and then when they were able to locate somehow the person who this child was talking about, they found out that actually the circumstances of death and the specifics of the killing reflected the birthmarks of the child. Let's say the child had a birthmark in the place where the person who was the protagonist in the previous lifetime had the mortal wound.